again.
This is Rebecca Naldo, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Are We There Yet? A quirky travel guide to the Southwest and beyond. The perfect three-day weekend in Chicago. Here's what to see, do, and eat on a long weekend trip to Chicago. By Mina Thurvegodden. Updated on February 13th, 2024. If you're looking for a quick escape, there's nowhere better than Chicago to spend a few days. It's easy to get to Chicago from almost anywhere in the U.S., and there's plenty to do and eat than you'll have in terms of time and appetite. Here's how to have the perfect three-day weekend in Chicago. Day 1. Kick off your long weekend in Chicago with a trip to Cloud Gate in Millennium Park. The sculpture, known colloquially as the Bean, is made up of 168 pieces of stainless steel pieced together without any visible seams. The Bean is one of the most photographed spots in the city and has a 12-foot arch with an underside that warps and multiplies reflections. Once you've gotten your perfect selfie, walk over to the Art Institute of Chicago to explore almost 1 million square feet of art, including Picasso's The Old Guitarist, Edward Hopper's Nighthawks, and Grant Wood's American Gothic. When you're done, wander through Grant Park and check out Buckingham Fountain, as well as Chicago's public art scene. Head across the river for an Italian beef sandwich from Portillo's for lunch. Then hit the deck. The Skydeck Chicago at the Willis Tower, that is. Formerly known as Sears Tower, this 110-story skyscraper held the title of the tallest building in the world for almost 25 years. Enjoying the view from its observation deck is arguably one of the best things to do in Chicago. For dinner, grab a table at Quartino for a lively, family-style Italian meal. Don't miss the eggplant parmesan, and do make reservations ahead of time. Day 2. Start your Saturday in Hyde Park with brunch at Valois Restaurant, former President Barack Obama's favorite diner in the city. Try one of his go-to dishes, the steak omelet with hash browns. Then head to the University of Chicago campus and visit Robie House, designed by the famous architect Frank Lloyd Wright, who called the Chicago area home for the first 20 years of his career. Afterward, ride the iconic L train north to pay Sue the Tyrannosaurus Rex a visit at the Field Museum. As one of the largest natural history museums in the world, it's a dinosaur geek's paradise. While you're there, walk over to Soldier Field, the picturesque home of the Chicago Bears, for a stadium tour. A VIP tour for $25 allows visitors to spend 15 minutes on the field. Next, head to Giordano's, Gino's East, or Lou Malnati's for a deep dish pizza for dinner. Then make your way uptown for a jazz show at the Green Mill. Al Capone was once a regular at the lounge, and his favorite booth is still standing. If the Green Mill looks familiar, it's because you may have seen it in High Fidelity, Prelude to a Kiss, and Soul Food. Day 3. Make a quick stop at the Donut Vault in River North for a sweet start to your Sunday. Doors open at 7:30 a.m. You'll want to get there early because the donuts never last long. Afterward, head to the corner of Michigan Avenue and Wacker Drive for the Chicago Architecture Foundation's River Cruise. This 1.5-hour boat tour is well worth the $54 price tag and is one of the best ways to see Chicago and learn about the city's architectural history. The cruise passes by icons, including the Merchandise Mart, a building so big it once had its own zip code, and Marina City, a pair of residential towers known as the Corn Cobs. Stroll by the Chicago Theater, then stop for lunch at Rick Bayless's flagship Mexican restaurant, Frontera Grill. The restaurant won a James Beard Award in 2007 and has been a local favorite for decades. Catch an afternoon comedy show at the Second City, which has hosted celebs including John Candy, Joan Rivers, Stephen Colbert, and Bill Murray. Then head to dinner in Andersonville, a Swedish enclave on the north edge of the city that's a rare oasis from national chains. Cap off your weekend in Chicago with a meal at Hopleaf, known for its mussels and fries, expansive craft beer selection, and CB&J, a cashew butter, raclette cheese, and fig jam sandwich. An excerpt, A Chef's Guide to Eating Out in Chicago, by the Serious Eats team, last updated April 8, 2022. From architectural feats and notoriously loyal sports fans to public sculptures and hip-hop, Chicago is known for many things, and chief among them might be its iconic food. No matter your opinion on the stuff, who here can say they've never heard of Chicago deep dish? Topping heavy Chicago-style hot dogs, sky-high stuffed pizzas, piping hot Italian beef sandwiches, and a shot or three of Jepson's Malort are certainly all worth enjoying when you're in town, but make sure you leave some room in your itinerary and your belly for exploring the lesser-known side of the city's food scene. Chi-Town has its fair share of celebrity chefs and a handful of restaurants you've definitely heard of. Rick Bayless's empire of Mexican restaurants is still going strong, and the far-reaching influence of Grand Arcat's molecular gastronomy powerhouse, Alinea, Next, and the Aviary can't be denied. But Chicago also boasts a rich and culinarily diverse food scene that reflects the fabric of the city. If you know where to look, you'll find unexpected fusion cuisine, Polish-Korean diner food, as delicious as it sounds, world-class cocktail spots with stellar bar bites, late-night joints that hand out cookies at midnight, and holes in the wall where you can get hearty, stick-to-your-rib soups and stews to power you through any Chicago winter. To help you navigate the many outstanding options, we turn to the folks who probably know the most about eating and drinking in Chicago, a handful of our favorite local chefs. These include Diana Davila of Mitocaya Antajaria, a neighborhood Mexican restaurant and James Beard Award finalist, Abraham Conlin of Fat Rice, a universally beloved restaurant serving comfort food from around the world, Ethan Pikas of Cafe Bistro Cellar Door Provisions, Q. Ibrahim of the Underground Pop-Up Dinner Series, Erling Wubauer of brand new rooftop hotspot The Laurel Room and Pacific Standard Time, a much-lauded, California-inspired, wood-fired oven restaurant, and Dana Cree of the playful ice cream shop Pretty Cool Ice Cream, known for ice cream bars and pops and fun flavors like sour cherry pie, Thai tea, and peanut butter potato chip. Below, they point the way to some of their favorite places for late-night eats, drinks, breakfast and brunch, special occasion meals, and of course, iconic Chicago foods. Read on to find out where chefs eat in Chicago. Best Late Night Eats. Excellent burgers, midnight cookies, after-hours dim sum, and no-frills spots for hearty Kyrgyzstani cuisine, Chicago has all the late-night eats a hungry night owl could want. Triple Crown. Triple Crown is actually the first place I ever went to for dim sum, and I don't think I realized how good their food was until I started having dim sum from other places. I've dined there at many different times of day, and it's consistently delicious. The fact that they're also open late is amazing, since I don't get to go out for brunch too often. Every now and again, my husband and I will treat ourselves and be like, you know what? After we close the restaurant, let's go get dim sum. Triple Crown isn't some little hole in the wall. This place is super big, and it's right in the heart of Chinatown in Chicago. Honestly, it looks like it would be this touristy bullshit place, but it's really, really good. And they have this eggplant that's stuffed with shrimp, and their Shanghai dumplings are awesome. They're soup dumplings, so they pop in your mouth with broth. I also love the turnip cakes with XO sauce. Garib Nawaz. Garib Nawaz looks like a basic cafe, nothing fancy about it at all. No flowers, no tablecloths, and you eat at a communal table, but it's open 24 hours, it's super cool, and the food is insanely good. The menu is so vast in variety, and it's crazy to see the diversity of people who go there. Late at night, you see clubbers go there. You see students from Northwestern, Loyola, DePaul. All the Chicago taxi drivers are there at 3 or 4 a.m. It's just traditional, good Indian food. You get a lot of carbs, rice, and bread. But then you'll get lamb, goat, or vegetarian options too. I love their goat. They have curry goat or roasted, and there's a spinach paneer that's really good. And of course, order the naan. Bai Cafe. Bai Cafe serves Central Asian cuisine, kind of a combination of Northern Chinese and Russian and Turkish cooking. And it's open quite late, which is nice, especially if you're hungry after service, after the bar, or after working out, or whatever people do late at night. For me, it's just a basic hole-in-the-wall place with hardly a sign and no menu. I've come to know them over the years. There's a little window, and you kind of look in the back and ask, "What kind of soup do you have today?" or "What have you made today?" They always have at least two, sometimes three soups that are fantastic for the Chicago winter. The lamb soup is just a basic, beautifully clear broth with one big chunk of fully, perfectly cooked potato, a nice big chunk of carrot, also perfectly fully cooked, and you can kind of cut it with your spoon. Sometimes a piece of tomato and a little cilantro on top. You can get a whole lamb chop in there sometimes. It's not medium rare, but it's juicy and tender. They also always have the borscht, which has big chunks of beef in it, and lots of finely sliced cabbage, and a big glob of super thick sour cream. You get nice hot tea, really, really strong tea. Everything has meat and onions. It's just hearty and fresh and delicious. Scofflaw. Scofflaw is tucked away in a little pocket of Logan Square, southwest of all the hubbub. It's a baroque, dark, literal gin joint where you can feel free to come as you are, whether it's after a long shift or for an evening out with friends. While other chef-driven restaurants are popping up around that area, Scofflaw has been holding down the corner of Armitage and Kedzie since 2012. The burger is a delicious take on the In-N-Out style, something I yearn for as a West Coast transplant. But it's the fresh-baked chocolate chip cookies that are handed out at midnight that make for return visits. It's a late-night vibe with a touch of grandmother's love. I also love Scofflaw because of the chef, Matt Leto, is such a gosh-darn good cook. With chops earned under Suzanne Goyne and Paul Kahan, he's made a tiny neighborhood gin joint as delicious as the drinks are cold. Best drinks. Whether you're looking for a dive bar that makes you feel at home or a complex cocktail made with spirits you've never encountered before, Chicago doesn't disappoint. Skylark. My lady and I like to have a drink at a dive bar every now and again. I kind of have a go-to dive bar in every neighborhood. There's certainly a feel to them. The feel of a weathered bar, the feel of a good old coaster. But more than anything else, it's the feel of the staff that's been there, usually for a decade, and seen the neighborhood change a lot. I can talk about what's happened in the neighborhood. One of the other things I love about a dive bar is having some space around your shoulders. People aren't packed in there like sardines. I think it's one of the most honest feelings of a restaurant goer or a bar goer. You walk into a place and you just relax your shoulders. This is what hospitality is all about, just making somebody exhale. I live in Pilsen, which is the neighborhood very close to downtown that's really starting to develop. And in Pilsen is a place called Skylark, which I absolutely love. It's a beer and shot type of place. They have a tater tot tasting that's one of the funniest plates of food in Chicago. Kumiko. Chicago has an amazing cocktail culture, an amazing cocktail execution. To me, the biggest problem with cocktails is sugar and dilution. If you add too much sugar, or you don't have enough dilution, then you just can't taste all of the ingredients and everything that's in them. Julia Mimose, the beverage director at Kumiko, she gets it. She nails it. Her cocktails are ethereal, and they seem impossible. Her stuff is just so clean and has so much finesse. I remember sitting with her right after she started working at the aviary, many, many years ago. She had her little moleskin, and she was writing down all the things she wanted to make and her philosophies and everything in the book. She's not trying to be funny. She's not trying to be over the top. She's not trying to punch you in the face. She's not trying to impress you even. It's just really very refined, very thoughtful. She's a chef in that regard. And then they have those cool little plates from Noah Sandoval. He's really refined too, so their styles match up. Read your way around Chicago. Chicago is a city of bookish abundance, home to countless literary giants, past and present. The author, Rebecca Mackay, recommends works that capture its spirit. By Rebecca Mackay, published December 11, 2024. Chicago is too big, enormous in both geography and spirit, to capture it in its entirety. Locals understand this, and if you find a book set in a non-specific Chicago, a book purporting to take the whole place as its subject, or one that assumes downtown is the entire ethos, you know it was written by someone who only visits. To write well about Chicago is usually to write about specific blocks, buildings, or ethnic enclaves. This is the DNA of Chicago literature: neighborhood as subject, neighborhood as map of the heart. Of course, what makes up a neighborhood isn't just the people and the map, but history, and Chicago is somewhat unique in its evident layers of time. In no other city of this size and grandeur would the one-story hardware store that's only open on Wednesdays or the record store that sells 10 LPs a week survive into 2024. It's possible here to turn a certain corner and forget that it's not 1973 or 1952 or 1899. Chicago literature, too, tends to take the city's past as part of its present. If you're visiting in person or through books, you do well to read your way not only into every neighborhood, but into every era of the city. What should I read to discover the Chicago of yesteryear? Plenty of Chicago reading lists begin and end with the first half of the 20th century. And while I don't love that, you could do worse than start with this heady time when the city, in the wake of 1871's Great Fire, was busy reinventing itself and self-mythologizing. You can start with your old-school deep dive into Theodore Dreiser's Sister Carrie, a 1900 realist novel about a Wisconsin girl who comes to Chicago and get mixed up with everything from acting to robbery. Next, try Carl Sandburg's Chicago Poems, the collection that contains Chicago, the one about the hog butcher for the world, stormy, husky, brawling, City of the Big Shoulders. Sandburg first published the poem in 1914 in Chicago's own Poetry Magazine, founded 2 years earlier by Harriet Monroe. You might move on to Richard Wright's 1945 memoir, Black Boy, which starts with Wright's upbringing in the South, but winds up on the South Side of Chicago among 1930s Marxists and writers. And then there's Nelson Algren's 1949 novel, The Man with the Golden Arm, about a World War II veteran's struggles in the old Polish downtown, which was the first recipient of the National Book Award for Fiction. Although really, my favorite thing about Algren is that his torrid affair with Simone de Beauvoir led to de Beauvoir, then 39, experiencing her first orgasm. Chicago can leave you breathless like that. What about the Chicago my uncle grew up in? Let's say you made the wise and bold move to forge ahead into the second half of the 20th century, the time when modern Chicago, with all its problems, but all its creative power, took shape. Start with the writers of the Chicago Black Renaissance that began in the 1930s, but blossomed in the mid-1950s. Any of Gwendolyn Brooks's poetry will do you well, but Annie Allen, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1950, focuses on a young woman's coming of age in Bronzeville, and the novella Maud Martha, Brooks's only fiction, continues its themes. Lorraine Hansberry's 1959 play, A Raisin in the Sun, set on the South Side, was just the beginning of what the writer might have accomplished had she lived longer. The mysterious mid-century figure, Bette Howland, was all but forgotten until her selected stories appeared, after her death, in the 2019 collection Calm Sea and Prosperous Voyage.
a divorced single mother and the sometime lover of Saul Bellow, Howland wrote about Chicago and heartbreak, and she's one of the best writers you probably haven't read. You could also, of course, read Bellows's The Adventure of Augie March, a fictionalized account of the author's childhood on Chicago's Jewish West Side. Studs Terkel's Chicago, a Pulitzer-winning oral historian's ode to the city, came out in 1986, and you're obliged to read it aloud with a cigar in your mouth. We can't let you leave without reading Sandra Cisneros' 1984 novel, The House on Mango Street, and Stuart Dybeck's 1990 short story collection, The Coast of Chicago, about, respectively, a neighborhood much like Cisneros' own Humboldt Park, and Dybeck's native Polish South Side. What's going on today? Just about everything. Here's a city big enough to hold multiple presses, universities, book festivals, and dozens of independent bookstores. But unburdened by New York's big publishing climate or LA's I'm also a director vibes. In short, it's literary heaven. Many authors still follow that Chicago tradition of neighborhood as subject. Toya Wolff's Last Summer on State Street is a brilliant debut novel about girls in the Robert Taylor Public Housing Project. Claire Lombardo's The Most Fun We Ever Had, another spectacular debut, tackles family life in Oak Park. Kathleen Rooney's O Democracy takes on Chicago and national politics in 2008. Alex Kaldowitz has continued the project of sociological journalism begun in 1991's There Are No Children Here. His landmark story of two brothers growing up in a West Side housing project, with books such as An American Summer, which grapples with gun violence. Alexander Herman's The Lazarus Project examines, in fiction, the real murder of an immigrant teenager by a Chicago police officer in 1908. Chicago is a genre-bending city, and many recent works carve out their own space. The four Breakbeat Poets anthologies published by Chicago's own Haymarket Books include poets from all over, but deftly highlight the hip-hop, poetry, spoken word nexus that makes this the best poetry town in the country. Emile Ferris's graphic novel, My Favorite Thing is Monsters, is part coming-of-age story, part mystery novel, and part B-movie horror. The much-awaited sequel finally arrived this spring. Ensemble, an oral history of Chicago's unique theater scene, improv meets experimental, meets comedy, meets highbrow, meets DIY, compiled by Mark Larson, is riveting. I've got 2 days in town. Where can I see Literary Chicago? Start your first day at the Newberry Library, the free independent research library of your Gilded Age fantasies, which is open to the public and holds everything from a first folio to the archival records of local dance companies. Next, head to the newish American Writers Museum on Michigan Avenue. While the museum is dedicated to all American writers, there's a proud emphasis on Chicago's homegrown authors. A few blocks south, ride the elevator to the 10th floor of the Fine Arts Building, then wind your way through the hallways and descend floor by floor, taking in the door plaques for L. Frank Braun's Old Studio, the room where Poetry Magazine began, and Frank Lloyd Wright's one-time office. You'll also hear music lessons, see a puppet studio, a violin maker's workshop, and a paperweight gallery, and smell the paint from the artist's studios. Stop on the second floor at Exile in Bookville, an indie bookstore with the coolest music selection, best collection of small press books, and best views in the city. And if you happen to come on a Thursday night, you might find yourself in the live audience for NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me in the Ground Floor Theater. Day two is for the suburbs. In Oak Park, you can take a guided tour of Ernest Hemingway's birthplace, as well as Frank Lloyd Wright's first adult home and studio. Then make your way north to Lake Forest, where, if you're very lucky, the storied artist residency Ragdale may be open to the public, with a summer dance or music performance. This is the place where, after coming for a visual art residency, Audrey Niffenegger decided to try her hand at fiction and instead came out with The Time Traveler's Wife. In the early 20th century, when there was still the private home of an architect, Carl Stanberg, Vakel Lindsay, and Harriet Monroe spent time here. On your way out of town, drive by the childhood home of Ginerva King, F. Scott Fitzgerald's model for Daisy Buchanan. But wait, your flight was delayed, and you've got one more hour in the city. Take your inner child, or actual child, to Oz Park, where statues of Dorothy, the Tin Man, and Scarecrow, and the Cowardly Lion guard the city's playing toddlers and remind visitors that Brahm was looking out his window at a miraculous and very real city as he invented his emerald one. Isaac Newton claimed he'd only seen so far by standing on the shoulders of giants. That's how I feel as a writer in Chicago, supported and inspired by the Chicago literary tradition and its stalwart practitioners. We're spoiled for literary giants, past and present, and this is, don't forget it, the city of big shoulders. This is Rebecca Naldo, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading for Are We There Yet? A quirky travel guide to the Southwest and beyond.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.